Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest, L.A. poet, choreographer, and so much more, Peggy DeGreer. How are you, Peggy?
I'm doing great, Rich. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's a real pleasure. Peggy DeGreer is a poet, a choreographer, a longtime student of mystical traditions, and an irrepressible curator of new combinations. Her poetry has been published in journals such as San Pedro River Review and Yoga Magazine. Her most recent anthologies include The Night Goes On All Night, A Poet is a Poet No Matter How Tall, and Ekphrastia. Peggy is co-author of 64 Ways to Practice Nonviolence, a curriculum and resource guide, and her most recent poetry collection, In the Lake of Your Bones, was published by Moontide Press in March 2012. Speaking of In the Lake of Your Bones, Peggy, I was hoping you could start today's show with reading a poem from that collection, perhaps one of your pieces entitled Oh India.
Perfect. Oh India. I listened to George Harrison chant in Sanskrit until a wanderlust for Gujarat pounced on me like a loose litter of lion cubs. I was smitten and stricken, enamored and terrified, walking through intentions of passport acquisition and frequent flyers rejoice. I was once a tiny monk, maybe 8 or 9 lives old. I was wrapped in mango robes freshly spun from my mother's loom. I was walking contemplation, a view from eyes in the back of the head, looking in unless and until looking through. I was once a black-haired woman, bent at the well for water. Mustard flowers surrounded her head, held the threads of her shawl woven together. The colors illuminated her charity. I was once the vessel she held, the one which gathered the water. Om Masatoma Satgamaya, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. She was refreshment on the banks of the Ganges. I was that old gathering can.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful. You know, and again, that was called Oh India from Peggy DeGreer's most recent poetry collection, In the Lake of Your Bones. Peggy, that piece reminded me of something. You know, in hearing this work and in reading some of your other work, there's an aspect of spirituality that flows throughout a lot of your work. I'm curious, what are the roots of that spirituality and how would you say it informs your work?
Well, I'm a student of yoga, and I've actually been a student of world religions since my college days. That was a sort of a minor area of study for me. And this particular poem, it's interesting because, recently I was working at Loyola Marymount University, and one of the first projects that I did there was to present an art exhibit of tankas that were done in Tibet by a study abroad group of students. And they had come back, and they had brought their tankas with them. And there's a particular study with tankas, and they all come out looking amazing. And these these lives are from the photographs that were included in that exhibit that the students took on their trip in India and Tibet. And so those characters that I talk about were all from those photographs.
Nice, nice. You know, the collection in the Lake of Your Bones, does the title in the Lake of Your Bones, does it hold a specific reference to something?
It's a line from one of the poems toward the end of the book called Fledgling Humans We, and it's just a direct line from the poem.
Do you have that poem handy by any chance?
I just happen to, but you might hear it.
As a matter of fact, well, why don't we go ahead
and hear it?
It's
an odd one, but I'd be happy to read it for you.
That'd be great.
Fledgling Humans We, and it starts with an epigraph that's entirely made up. The unruliness of my clock face, my breath, my sharp claw. Let words come all together, signs empathic, foreheads collide. We are meant for this. Fledgling humans, we. We become food at the table. A sawed-off barrel falls deep, comes right back when drawn up. Our skin melts in the heat of afternoon. I have caused this chasm of canyons. This dining car rides rails of extinction. Raw meat hangs on a hook. Sympathetic powders have been found. There is elasticity in my thoracic cavity. You mustn't say you've seen it if you never have. It's either magic or it's just hocus pocus. This is a crabgrass contemplation. Instead, say your name. Face your mantra in a singular drop of myrrh. Cover your head. Let the honey run. Let it be holy. Let it suckle at every pore of you, every seed, every fluid, every vice. Let it render a fierce Durga on the walls of your cave. Let it wade in the lake of your bones, read you in adequate light, cover to cover, looking up every unfamiliar word as you go.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you for reading that. You know, when you were putting the collection together, were there any particular themes or any particular ideas you were wanting to convey to the reader?
Well, I think it was an exploration. It was just sort of a sharing of my own exploration into love, into the spirituality of love, the growth that it can enable or inhibit, depending, you know, on what you do with it. And so there are a lot of types of love that I refer to in the book. You know, love of the earth, love of God, love of a sense of oneself that comes and goes. I address that a lot. There's a couple of poems that address my love of dance, which really was my first love, and then
that's actually
my daughter.
The next thing I want to talk to you about, yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. You know, speaking of dance, you have a very extensive dance background, and in fact, I believe your career might have even, you know, as far as your artistic career, dance might have even been some of your earliest roots. Can you talk about your experience in dance and where it's taken you?
Yeah, well, actually, I started in improv theater. I came out of college really inspired by Synergy Trust and the committee workshop, and went to San Francisco to direct a company that was called Uncut Theater. And we were in the basement of a church, and I was working in a bar. And one day I stepped out on the street to get some air, and I looked up, and over the bar where I was working, I saw this trapeze come into the window and then swing back out. And there was a woman up there named Terry Sengraf who was teaching something called motivity that I got very involved in quickly. And it was ground and aerial improvised gymnastics that flowed gradually and organically from dance onto a trapeze, onto a mat, up into a handstand. And it was really interesting. And then that group decided to explore a form called contact improvisation, which came out of Bennington College in 72. And this was in 73, and it was by modern dancers. They were studying Graham, and they also decided to study Taekwondo. And so they were looking for how do we share that flow of chi. And they began by bringing spiritual practice into their rehearsals and into their exploration by starting in standing meditation with each other. And I have over the years in different theater programs and, you know, come back to that. You know, where so much art, especially art that finds a mystical footing or a spiritual footing, comes from a practice of silence or
beautiful.
A practice of stillness, you know, out of which the movement or the sound comes. So I hope I answered that question.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting that you should say there was a ground and aerial element to that practice, because as you said it, I was sort of made a connection back to your poetry. And that's something that I really get from your work, sort of a ground and aerial approach, you know, something very rooted to the earth, very rooted to humanity, but also that aerial or the sort of mystical and spiritual aspect. So
the wacky side. Well, I think of it as a little wacky because it's, you know, it's undefinable. And, you know, one of the beauties of poetry is that it can embody something that you can't define or that you can't clearly identify, but you can get a feel, you can enter its landscape and wander around a little bit, you know, and maybe it reflects back on something going on in your life. That's why I came to poetry. And just to continue the thought, how dance led to poetry for me is, you know, as I got older and that became more difficult for me and I had some injuries, I started working with Simone Forti, who is a writer, you know, and you probably have met her around Beyond Baroque.
Sure, sure.
But she does something called Logomotion, which includes modern dance, and out of the movement, finding an image, picking an image, and then on the spot, writing it. And so that, you know, when I became unable to dance, my first poems were edited off of rehearsal tapes, doing that type of work or doing early one-woman shows that I did. And that became my first poetry. So,
Beautiful. I want to touch on something you just said. You mentioned the word editing. I'm curious, how extensive, when you're writing poetry, how extensive is your editing process? Or do you, is it sort of a thing where it just flows out and, you know, when you publish something or perform something, how much of that remains the same from when it first came out versus how much of it do you go back and with a keen editorial eye and pull stuff out, put things back in?
Yeah, good question. More and more, I edit more and more. I'm completely embarrassed by some of the work that I published early in my career when I never thought I would ever call myself a poet. I was just writing poetry to survive, and somebody would say, oh, let me put that on the internet, and I'd go, okay, here you go. And, you know, as I look back and I get more of a critical eye, and I don't like to have a critical eye at all in the writing, but as I get more of a critical eye as an editor, you know, I'm more cautious about how early I put things out, although I do share them with friends. My editing process is it varies from poem to poem. I just went through a period, and a poem I kind of like to read today about being at a crossroads, and it's a poem that came after I wrote a series of about 12 poems for a KFAM workshop, and then this one seems to be completely unrelated to any of that, but I don't think I could have written it without writing those other small pieces that came directly from a conversation in workshop. Do you know what I mean? And then
absolutely.
This one came
clear
out of the blue, and then I think this series is over now, you know?
Right.
Yeah,
well, let's hear it.
Oh, okay. Well, this one is so new, it's only on my phone, so. Right? But it's actually rather long, all right. I'm just waiting for it to fully load. Okay. At the crossroads. No one is doing the fandango at the crossroads. No fingertips flicking and flailing, no flirtation, no percussives whatsoever, no touch. Dancers never touch in fandango anyway, which is what it takes for this awkward dance of unknown destination to work. When the castanets are still, you don't hear them. No one shakes a feather, neither tail or funny bone, neither wing or pin. A skinny kid with a snake in a basket and a piccolo calling it forth stands in sandals and dirt at the crossing. He's a charmer, a master choreographer to the reptilian clan, busking for rupees on the road to Agra. The snake will slither and flop out onto the hard dirt over and over again, will give up its woven cave for a song. The charmer's baby sister, half his size, is terrified at their big work. Petals from a bundle of limes and a bag of turmeric, more practical than snake magic, keeps her distance but never out of range. They are serious, very, trying to set a course for others, make up minds for the road. The road is a hard sister, jaded and edgy. You carry water, provisions. You show up on the way, on the far north shore, in a treehouse maybe. You are read translations, not loud or clear, but whispers enough to know your intrusion. And the road makes its way clean through you. You chart a way back home.
That was beautiful. And that was called At the Crossroads?
Yeah, well, that title is definitely, maybe, probably, I would assume, going to change. But yeah,
I've got one of those I've been wrestling with for a while.
Like I said, it's very new, and if you can think of one, let me know.
I've got a piece that I've been working on. The title's changed about 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, and, you know, I've been at the crossroads in my life for a while now, you know, after leaving LMU and looking to sort of light and grab hold somewhere, and where
sure.
is that going to be? And it's a really, really exciting time. But I've been there a while, which is why I think this poem is a little longer than most of my poems and takes me back to India. Yeah, I actually saw that site at a crossroads on the way to Agra of a young boy with a snake in a basket.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes me back to places where I felt I was incredibly grounded there. And,
yeah.
you know, yeah, sometimes yeah. the poetry can provide that for us anyway.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. you know, speaking of being at a crossroads, I guess this relates to that to some degree or another. And we've kind of spoken about this before. I'm curious, you know, we write poetry, others write poetry or what we consider to be poetry. It may or may not be. I'm curious, what do you think gives someone the right to call themselves a poet?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm much easier with saying I write poetry, but I think that's because, you know, when I studied in Prague with Jim Reagan, he was just like, no, you don't call yourself a poet. You know, he just really felt that that was pretentious and that it's okay to say that you're a writer and you write poetry, but the title, I guess he feels, comes from someone else. I'm told constantly that I'm a poet, so right. It almost feels inauthentic for me to say that I'm not, but it isn't all of me. And, you know, I think I'm a dancer first. Even before that, I'm a woman. I'm a mother. You know, I'm somebody just trying to get by in the world. I mean, if I jump to poet, it's big. It's a lot to, you know.
That's a big leap.
It's a lot to answer for. And, you know, right. Sometimes the day-to-day is about is enough. But, no, I don't mean to be... you know, I don't mean to be frivolous about it, but it's a big, it's, you know, when people say things like people die daily for lack of what is found there, it's a responsibility. And I think, you know, that's a whole other question that we could spend a whole interview on, and I would love to have this conversation, is what is our responsibility as poets? Is it enough to tell our story? Is it okay to rant on and on and on about what breaks our heart? Or do we have a responsibility to try to move to solution, to try to inspire rather than bring down, rather than blame, accuse? I don't know. I know that there's certain rooms where poetry is being read that I'm no longer comfortable in. But I think it's all good from the perspective of the writing, of the process. And I appreciate people so much who can tailor and select a set based on their audience, you know, considering how their audience is receiving it. And making their audience, you know, I mean, I think it's okay to make people feel a little uncomfortable. That's how we create change. But, you know, I've sat in a room before where I felt attacked, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be that as a poet. So that's a good question. What's our responsibility as a poet? It seems a much greater responsibility than to be a dancer or a jeweler or, you know, or a painter. I don't know why it does to me, but it does. Does it to you?
Yeah, it does. And I really...
You went to jail for this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You know, nobody really goes to jail for dancing.
Yeah. That's funny.
So, anyway.
But in Russia, you can go to jail for being a musician.
That's true. And I guess all artists are really at risk. But there is something about saying it, and I think also for me, just because I'm coming to it as a second artistic medium, you know, that I've really invested in. I've never studied in a university. I've studied a lot with Brendan Constantine. I've studied a lot with Richard Garcia. Yeah, and I've studied a little with Cecilia Wallach and Sarah McClay and who else? Terry Wolverton and some other. You know, I think every time I go to a reading of somebody that inspires and lifts me, I'm studying. I want to go home and read more and then try out some of their prompts, you know?
Yeah.
Very inspired by Mindy Netafee, by Amber Tamlin, inspired by the work they do in the community, extending into art, you know. Love the project that Brendan and Elena Karina are doing at KFAM, and just am honored to participate in that. In fact, that's coming up on January 5th again.
And is that the Ekphrastia?
Well, that is ekphrastic poetry that corresponds with the exhibit at KFAM. And at the opening of the exhibit, there are really well-known artists, poets, that are commissioned to write on the exhibit for the opening. And then during the course of the exhibit, a workshop is given, and then those who come and write in the workshop do a closing reading. So I'll be participating in that on the 5th. And
nice.
But that's a really great project, and I hope that it continues, funding being what it is these days. Ekphrastia Gone Wild is a book that was edited by Rick Lupert from Poetry Superhighway. And I don't know if that's why he chose it, but knowing that LA Unified teachers are now required to teach ekphrasis as a way of students having an experience of embodiment of art, you know, now that they're no longer able to afford art specialists, ekphrasia has become a part of the curriculum. So Rick has sort of extended the release of the book, and many of the people who are in it who are teachers have written curriculum that teachers can, you know, download free on the internet and can see at Poetry Superhighway. So, you know, I'm a teacher at heart, and these things excite me, you know, wherever
nice.
We can share the poetry and do it in a way that brings it to people who wouldn't, you know, who might not otherwise get to enjoy it.
Yeah. You know,
yeah.
I want to touch back on your dance experience combined with poetry experience for a moment. You've spoken about the idea of using your body as an instrument, listening to your whole body. I was wondering if you could talk about that, those ideas.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited right now because talk about coming full circle. I'm getting ready to do a project at Gatsby's Books, and of course Gatsby's is not the biggest bookstore, so I'm hoping we'll get to do it again. But it is a dance piece that includes writing, and it's kind of based on, well, it's loosely based on a theater project called From the Coyote Cycle, which I worked with this company for many years. And each of the plays of this cycle that were based on coyote trickster myths, each of these plays had a exercise, a spiritual exercise that was attributed to the play and was used in the writing of the play and the development of the physicality of the play. And so for years, and particularly after I got injured, and I couldn't dance full out anymore, I started to use this one series called Listening to the Whole Body. And again, this is from a series of plays called From the Coyote Cycle that were originally written by Murray Mednick and by the actors who were part of the play and the development of the play. They also had a part in the writing. But in any case, I'll be doing that, and I came back to it because it was so restrained. And after an injury, I had a body memory of a much greater strength than I actually could support. So it helped me to have a very restrained, prescribed formula for moving, for entering into movement in a very concentrated, awake, aware, and restrained way. And so now I'm getting to use that and open it up in a movement piece, and in fact am going to be doing a little intro piece with Brendan, a piece that we wrote together kind of as an intro for it. And then we're also working with Daryl Larson, who was the original coyote character, and has just moved back to town after years of working on the East Coast and teaching at Columbia, and he's agreed to work with us on this, and so
nice.
We're very excited, and we'll see what happens. You know, it'll be a blip at Gatsby's, but I'm excited that it might lead me into a process where I could bring a little bit more dance back now to the poetry rather than the opposite way around.
Yeah.
So,
that would be great.
Yeah, does that answer your question?
Absolutely. You know, something else you've been doing these days, you've been creating shadow boxes. I want to hear more about that.
Ah, well, you know, I guess maybe not working and not getting as tired as I'm used to, because I usually work pretty full out when I work. I haven't slept very well, and, you know, I worried about it for a while, and then I just decided, well, I would make art in those hours that I was awake. And so I started making shadow boxes from little bits of miniatures and bones on the theme of the Lake of Your Bones. And
nice.
Each box sort of seems to coagulate or cohere around a line of poetry or a poem. I don't know if it really happened in advance, but it happened as I was making them. I went, oh, this is this one, and this is this. I've done about a half a dozen of them now, really in the last couple of weeks. And but they've been in process. I've been collecting the boxes and wanting to do it since probably about 10 years ago. I taught a class at Crossroads when I was teaching there, an options class that was inspired by a film that I saw on Eames, and it was an assemblage class. And I've done a lot of assemblage jewelry, like bola ties or pins made out of old broken stuff. But
nice.
These were boxes that I had in mind, larger environments. And you know, I live in a small place, so I just have never done it, but I've collected them. So finally, I just cleared up the dining room, and my dining room now looks like a studio. And I got further inspired because this last project at KFAM included poetry by Mary Ruffel. And Mary did a lot of erasure poems and small shadow boxes. Mine are quite extravagant. Compared to hers, they just have a lot more stuff in them. But I was very inspired by the simplicity of hers, and I think that may have been what finally triggered it and, you know, got them made after I've been thinking about them for, you know, a couple of years.
Are you by any chance familiar with the artist Joseph Cornell?
You know, it's really funny because my friend Daryl, who I spoke about just a few moments ago, we had our first meeting, and that's what he gave me. I showed him some
nice.
Pictures, and he gave me the book of Joseph Cornell. And there are so many similarities because, you know, he has a recurring theme of bubbles, as do I, and a recurring theme of eggs and timepieces. There are clocks in mine. And I think they're really iconic. They're iconic items that, you know, anybody making these boxes, I think, might reflect on, you know, an egg or a seed, just that origin
right.
of life, a timepiece, that man-made imposition on our, on everything.
absolutely.
I don't know. I have an attitude about time lately. So, yeah.
You know, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you a couple more questions before we part ways. You know, you have a passion for social change, nonviolence. At the beginning of the show, I mentioned that you that you co-authored 64 Ways to Practice Nonviolence, a curriculum and
mm-hmm.
resource guide. I'm curious, how did that come about for you, your passion for social change and nonviolence?
Well, I was born in the infirmary at March Air Force Base, and my early life was a product of World War II and the Korean conflict, and you know, that the trauma and drama of that played out in my family. And so, yeah, then I just got further interested in the idea of a humane world when I studied Anne Frank, you know, in middle school. And I just think it was one thing led to another. I was mortified. I could still remember where I stood the day JFK was assassinated. And just the idea that that kind of destruction of such great power, you know, really had no power over violence. And I learned somewhere early on that violence is born out of suffering. And it made me see the world very differently. And so as a teacher, and particularly as a parent, I wanted to share that. Grew up in a pretty volatile home. And, yeah, and I was really oversensitive. I mean, none of my family experienced it the way that I did. I think nobody experiences anything the same as anybody else. But later in my spiritual community, I was invited, because I did curriculum development professionally at that time. I was working at Crossroads in their Mysteries program, and which is a human development program. And some of my spiritual community members knew about that, and they asked me to come in and help develop this program. And that led to about a 12-year study of nonviolence, which was greatly inspiring and greatly uninspiring, equally.
How was it uninspiring?
Well, I'd much rather talk about how it was inspiring, because that's my commitment, is to be a benevolent force in the world. But
absolutely,
I think, you know, I will say simply that wherever you're doing peace work, it comes to be challenged greatly.
Yeah.
You know, it is, by its nature, will be challenged. Because power doesn't want that, you know, and
yeah,
power has power. And so, you know, people think that nonviolence means there's no conflict, but in fact, nonviolence creates conflict, you know, by refusing to comply with laws that don't make sense, you know. And
yeah,
so, you know, particularly in the last 10 years, it's easy to get disillusioned. As hard as I've worked to see the results squelched and squashed and disregarded, and, you know, Washington continue to ignore and work in such a non-humanitarian way in a country that was founded on equality and humanitarian ideals, is disheartening. And when you expose yourself to it a lot because you're working in it, it can hurt more than if you walk around in a fog, you know, which most Americans do, because it's just painful. You know,
yeah,
it is painful to see how we treat each other. Even among poets, it just surprises me about at how unkind somebody can be to somebody else for no apparent reason.
That's funny you should say that. You know, when I first came out to California from New Jersey after having graduated Rutgers University, first place I landed was San Francisco, and started getting into poetry. And, you know, I had this idea of poetry, what poetry was, what poets would be like. And, you know, when I started going to some of these readings in San Francisco, and you know, and I see it from time to time here in L.A., you know, there were some really genuinely beautiful people, you know, especially early on, some poets that took me under their wing and kind of helped guide me through the San Francisco community. But there were some really nasty, backbiting, poisonous poets. And that really threw me for a loop.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a trip. And, you know, it's not unique to poetry. It's unique to our culture. We're, we're a text message culture and very low touch. And, you know, people suffer from low touch. Whether they know it or not, they suffer from it. And so, we're kind of all walking around at levels of awareness and suffering. I don't mean to be, pessimistic.
No, that
was the negative. And particularly the people that you're walking with, when they start, in on you and won't sit at the table and discuss what needs to be done. It's very disheartening.
Yeah.
But the good news is that, you know, we can understand each other's suffering if we take the time to do it, and we can help repair each other if we take the time to do it. And when we do that, you know, we leave the world just what we call the beauty way at the Mysteries program, is you want to always leave the landscape that you've just been in a little bit better for the next person. Let them see something precious, even if it's just a leaf, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what's that?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, what you were just talking about is very important, and I definitely see that in your work. And if you were to consider, you know, that you are on some type of mission with your poetry, with your art, in addition to what you were just discussing, what else would you say would be involved, would be a part of the message that's your mission?
Oh, God, I don't know that I have a mission other than to save my own skin. But no, I guess it is to communicate. It is to, you know, I don't communicate easily. I do professionally more than personally. I think we all choose this kind of communication, you know, whether it's theater or dance or whatever, as a road to communicating and being understood and trying to, you know, organize our thinking in a way that makes it possible to go through a really impossible existence, you know. It's amazing what's asked of us, you know, just to survive in our culture. It's just amazing when you think about it, you know, where we've come from in 100 years. Kind of lost my train there.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, something you were just talking about communicating made me think of something. When you write a poem, do you think it's an act where you are working to communicate to yourself first and then to others, or perhaps the other way around, or a combination of both?
I guess it depends on the poem. I think when I first started, it was really just an activity, you know, for a creative activity to engage in. And, you know, that's something that I've learned in writing plays and dancing and doing choreography and, you know, just that there's just good work that goes on that you may not be aware of when you're just engaged in some kind of creative activity, even if you don't have a sense, oh, I'm going to be this, you know, I'm going to sell this. Yeah. I didn't make these shadow boxes thinking, oh, I'm going to put them in a gallery or I don't know what I'm going to do. I just made them. You know, there was just something that needed expression. So I think, yeah, maybe it happens for me first. But more recently, writing in collaboration, I think I am trying to communicate something to the collaborator, to the audience. You know, I want to feel like there's some purpose beyond just stringing fancy words together. I'd like to think that. I don't know if it's true. But, you know, I've heard people say to me, in fact, Brenda Petrakis used to say this to me all the time, which I found interesting, that my poetry was a ministry. That it was my ministry. And it's interesting because, you know, I studied religious science on my spiritual path, and I became a religious science practitioner. And, you know, I did that for a living for a while, and I considered becoming a minister, because I was so involved in the study of mysticism and the practice of mysticism, you know. But at some point, I realized it wasn't my calling to be involved in a church, and or at least not at that point in life, that really I was meant to be more in a classroom.
Yeah. I'd love it if you could close today's show out with another poem. Is that possible?
Sure.
Cool.
I'll finish with this piece. It's kind of a funny piece, but it's about writing. So it's an Ars Poetica piece, and it came from a prompt where we wrote for a fundraiser for a friend of ours, and we're looking at how poetry can save your life. It's called The Enteric System, and starts with an epigraph by Abraham Lincoln. When you have an elephant by the hind legs and he's trying to run away, it's best to let him go. The Enteric System. It's hard to tell a small pink elephant from a pig. If both wear bindis, it's even worse. A paradox. A blended arithmetic of third eyes and mantras that confuses even the most careful observer. Who but Purusha is an impartial witness? Elephants will mourn their dead with extravagant attention for days on end. Their back feet read the auric field, trunk to the bone till the marrow dries, scanning for some known ancestry. A message of how to go on, more like a blessing of vultures that fords a stream of mysterious skies. Some sows will wallow in their dirt, sorry for their pigness. Others will know their nature, bless the pen, and write their way back to the herd.
That was beautiful. Right their way back to the herd. What a beautiful line. I also love that line, if both wear bindies, it's even worse. That's beautiful and funny at the same time.
Yeah, definitely do have that Eastern, that influence, you know.
Yeah. Peggy DeBrier, it's been such an honor and pleasure to have you on the show. I could listen to you speak for hours on, and you have such great things to say about poetry and life and spirituality. What's the best way for people to find out about you online?
Oh, thank you so much, Rich, and for all of that you just said. And the best way is just www.peggydebrier.com. And there's a contact through there if you want books or you want to hear about things coming up. I don't always get them on that website because it's just being remade. Email me, and I'd be happy to tell you what's coming up.
Nice. Well, thanks again for being on the show, Peggy. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth and Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week. Very excited to have as my first guest for 2014, the world-renowned writer and educator, Amy Bender. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.